Hello, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm David Rogowski, and today I will be reading from Outside Magazine. Next up, we have I Worked Out Like 82-year-old Mick Jagger for a Week. Here's what happened. Mick Jagger is in incredible shape for a person of any age. How does he do it? I followed his training plan to find out. This is by Riley Nusili. Mick Jagger is 82 years old and on the Rolling Stones Hackney Diamonds Tour. The show runs somewhere between 2 and 2.5 hours long. Jagger is running, gyrating, singing, and dancing at each one. I couldn't help but notice that Jagger is in incredible shape. For a person at any age, how does he do it? And what would it feel like to work out like him? So how to work out like Mick Jagger? Jagger has worked with Norwegian personal trainer Torje Eike for many years, and online sources cite yoga, dancing, strength training, sprinting, and meditation as the types of workouts that Jagger tends to do 5 to 6 days each week. Using these online sources, along with videos Jagger has shared and interviews he has given, I put together a 5-day Jagger workout plan that incorporates each of his core fitness practices. And then I tried it. Day 1, 1 hour of vinyasa yoga to start the day. I decided to start my Jagger week in my comfort zone with a form of physical activity we both seem to love, yoga. I practice vinyasa 2 to 3 times a week and have done so on and off for a decade. Today's class started with a dash of kismet, though. The instructor at my usual studio, Beloved Yoga, asked if anyone in the room was familiar with Rick Rubin. Surely she can't be talking about the record producer, right? I thought to myself as I tentatively raised my hand, but Rick Rubin, the unparalleled American producer of albums ranging from the Beastie Boys' 1984 License to Ill to Mick Jagger's 1993 Wandering Spirit, was exactly who she was talking about. She used Rubin's thoughts on creativity to ground that day's practice, which ended up going pretty heavy on the chair pose, if you ask me. Mick, are you here with us in the room right now? Day 2, Transcendental Meditation and Strength Training. I'm not going to lie, I was dreading the meditation component of Jagger's routine. Any source online will tell you that meditation is one of his major habits. Except, and this is important, I have spent at least 15 of my 36 years on the planet very aware that meditation might help quiet my usually screaming mind, but I always refuse to do it because it sounds like a little too quiet. And 15 minutes sounds like a very long time. So, since I'm a meditation avoider and thus a total novice, I did some cursory research on transcendental meditation before I sat down to try it. From what I read, picking a mantra, one that has consists of sounds versus meaning, and repeating that mantra throughout the practice serves as step 1. Step 2 is sitting for 15 to 20 minutes twice a day, choosing a comfortable position and repeating the mantra until the end of the allotted time. Obviously, I went for the 15-minute option. I chose a classic Sanskrit Om as my mantra and settled into a comfortable position in my office and guest room. As the minutes ticked by, I resisted the urge to check my remaining time on my phone and to focus on the meditation. And honestly, it was kind of great. The time passed much faster than I expected. I assumed I was around the 5-minute mark when the timer went off to signal 15. Repeating the mantra made it easier to push out intrusive thoughts, and I felt myself settle into silence in a way that is usually pretty elusive to me. I think I might keep meditating even after my Jagger week. Oh, I also did strength training on day 2, because Jagger gets in a few good gym workouts each week, and weight training is already a part of my regular routine. I perform bench presses, shoulder presses, tricep extensions, flies, concentration curls, medicine ball twists, incline bench with dumbbells, and kettlebell shrugs. Not bad. Day 3. 1+ hours of vinyasa and sprints. Most places I looked online included a striking detail about Jagger's purported regimen. In the past, at least, he's done sprints to keep in shape. A lifetime ago, I too regularly did 100-meter sprints, and I was actually very good at them. I was a high school soccer player who set the all-time scoring record for the sport at my high school because, in addition to a strong right foot, I was just really fast. But then close to 20 years elapsed, and I became a sedentary knowledge worker and had a baby. I can't say sprinting is part of my week unless we're talking about hustling behind my child after she darts towards the street in front of our house. So sprinting hurt, and I went relatively easy on myself since it's been a while. I opted to do 4 100-meter sprints with a 10-minute warm-up consisting of a short jog, leg swings, and some stretching. I tried to be reasonable too and get some negative splits going by starting at around 70% of my already diminished sprinting capacity. I was huffing and puffing by the end, but I made it through, which is my singular goal for this exercise. I should note that I also did 1 hour and 15 minutes of vinyasa yoga in the evening. I'm not sure if Mick Jagger combines workout types across his days, but I have to imagine that if he's feeling up to it, he does. Day 4, dance workout. No Jagger workout week could exist without at least one dance workout. And in one 2024 interview with Reuters, Jag said he does 2 dance workouts a week. I kept it simple and found a 30-minute dance workout on YouTube, though I'm certain Jagger must be able to dance for much longer stretches. Dancing isn't all part of my regular regimen, and it was hard. It required coordination and speed, and I had to keep my eyes on the screen to be able to follow the instructions with any semblance of proficiency. I think the cardio component of this workout is great, and I totally get why it makes sense for someone performing I can't get no satisfaction on the regular. But I'm not sure I'd subject myself to this particular form of training again. My dancing is best saved for family wedding receptions. And day 5, strength training. On my final day of Jagger week, I repeated my strength training circuit from day 2. This is my regular lifting routine and makes my arms and back feel strong and pliable. I figured I would end the Jagger week in my own comfort zone. Should you work out like Mick Jagger? I spoke with Kristen Gaines, a former Division I athlete, Soul Cycle instructor, and certified personal trainer, to get her take on the workout plan I put together, as well as what she would suggest for anyone who really does want to get started working out like Jagger. Gaines told me it would be best to ease into Jagger-style workout if you're a relatively sedentary person. She recommends working out 2 to 3 times per week for the first month, building up to 4 times per week in month 2, and maxing out at 5 to 6 times per week in month 3. For the first month, I would suggest strength training 2 times per week and cardio once a week, she says. Strength training will help prevent injuries and will give your muscles a foundation to take on other activities such as dance or yoga. If my week as Mick Jagger taught me anything, it's that a diversified workout plan and a focus on mindfulness really felt good. If I were to habituate some of what I tested out this week and move beyond the initial soreness, I think I would feel real balanced and strong. And as Gaines reminded me, the most important thing to remember when starting any routine is to take it easy on yourself. Have patience in building a program that works best for you, but also patience in getting the results you are looking for, she says. The best way to build a Jagger-style regimen would be over time, so patience is key. So that was an article on how to work out like Mick Jagger. This is by Riley Nicelli, is the former director of digital content at National Geographic and the former digital managing editor at Outside Online. Sturgill Simpson is her favorite musician, but she's not sure what he does to stay in shape. And our next article is entitled, I visited every U.S. national park. My favorite might surprise you. People often ask me which park I like the most. My answer surprises them. This is by Emily Pennington. In January 2020, I packed my entire life into an old Ford Transit minivan, kissed my partner goodbye, and set off to visit every national park in the United States. Along the way, I penned a series of dispatches for Outside and wrote a book about all my wild experiences. Like the time an enormous black bear approached my picnic table in Kings Canyon, California. Panicked, I waved my arms overhead like a lunatic and tap danced on the wooden surface until it finally turned and sauntered into the woods. Or the time I came down with scarlet fever in the Alaskan bush and lolled around in my tent with a high fever for 2 days until my bush planes returned. Or the 4 days I spent trapped in a Tacoma motel room waiting out the smoke of the worst wildfire season in U.S. history before visiting North Cascades. My year exploring parks was never boring. In fact, it's been the biggest adventure of my life. America's national parks have some of the most jaw-dropping scenery on the planet. In addition to the iconic topography, hoodoos and canyons in the southwest, massive trees in California, and geysers that shoot water up hundreds of feet, I've also been awed by the green-black waters, Congaree, the magnificence of Denali, North America's highest peak, and fall foliage in Acadia. But my absolute favorite park? I get that question a lot, and the answer often surprises people. My favorite national park is Big Bend in Texas. I grew up in the suburbs of Houston, and a region I best remember is flat and swampy, and then moved to Los Angeles for college. Because my family wasn't very outdoorsy, I had no idea that extraordinary expanse of conifer top peaks and narrow river canyons was a day's drive away. In LA, I could easily go for a day hike in the Hollywood Hills or spend the weekend exploring San Gabriel Mountains National Monument. The topography and its proximity to it started to change me. Fast forward 15 years and picture me rolling into Big Bend National Park, delighted and surprised. The pine-freckled Chisos Mountains towered before me. I spent 4 days roaming the park, canoeing the Rio Grande, soaking in the natural hot springs, and trekking ridgelines that afforded panoramic views of the Chihuahuan Desert. Although Big Bend happened less than 2 months into my transition to full-time van life, the impression it had on me lasted the duration of my trip. Unlike the most popular parks like Rocky Mountain, Big Bend's natural attractions were unexpected. It was so off the beaten path, but there were many other reasons I fell in love with this West Texas gem. Here are a handful. You feel like you have Big Bend National Park to yourself. Relative to its size, it's the 15th largest unit in the park system, and a variety of outdoor activities, Big Bend is one of our least crowded parks outside of Alaska. In 2023, it welcomed just over 500,000 visitors to its 101,163 acres. Yosemite, in comparison, had 3.9 million visitors exploring just 747,956 acres. While visiting Yosemite Valley can feel like Disneyland, Big Bend felt like a serene desert refuge, which can actually be quite colorful and filled with animals. Big Ben is a haven for backcountry campers. Want to hike in and pitch your tent at a dispersed site in the Chisos Mountains? Raft a portion of the Rio Grande to a solitary camping zone? Take your four-wheel drive vehicle down a dirt lane to a designated roadside campsite with no one else around? There are even a few rugged off-trail wilderness areas where experienced backpackers can trek in and stay the night. The park makes it easy to score a permit for any of these, and they're inexpensive, around $10 per night. You can stargaze like a pro in Big Bend. Big Bend International Dark Sky Reserve is the largest dark sky certified place in the world. Nearby vacation rentals offer observatory access and the park hosts ranger-led night sky programs throughout the year. While I visited at the end of the winter, I was still dazzled by the twinkling Milky Way above my campsite one clear night. And the canyons in Big Bend are totally impressive. I was utterly wowed by the majestic canyons in Big Bend, and that's saying something, given how many national park canyons I enjoyed in the Southwest. I can recommend two short, easy hikes that take in some of the park's canyon highlights. Santa Elena Canyon Trail. To get to the trailhead, which is located on the western side of the park, drive the length of the view-studded Ross Maxwell Scenic Drive, passing rock formations that resemble mule's ears and the lumpy volcanic tuff canyons, and park at the lot at the end of the road. Spend an evening strolling this 1.4-mile out-and-back trail, which winds along the bottom of 1,500-foot-tall canyon walls, a nesting site for many birds bordering the Rio Grande. Boquillas Canyon Trail. On the eastern side of the park, this impressive 1.3-mile round-trip jaunt takes you near the Boquilla del Carmen border, crossing into Mexico. Go in the morning as I did for the best light on the caramel-colored limestone walls. It's worth noting that you can explore both these canyons via boat. I signed up for a guided excursion with Big Bend River Tours for $82 and can recommend this local outfitter. It offers a range of options from half-day to multi-day trips. There's a great hot spring site in Big Bend for post-trek soaking. After 3 days of non-stop park exploration, my muscles were sore, so I was happy to hear about two-wheel drive accessible hot springs inside Big Bend, Boquillas Hot Springs. The stone ruins of an early 1900s resort surround this naturally fed soaking pool tucked against the cool waters of the Rio Grande. From the Chisos Basin Visitor Center, head east for 28 miles. The last 2 miles are down bumpy dirt hot springs road, which ends at a parking lot. From there, it's an easy half-mile hike to the springs, where 105-degree pools and great views across the river into Mexico await. Big Bend's gateway town is weird, wonderful, and definitely worth a stop. Big Bend boasts one of the coolest gateway towns of any national park. From its sincerely sweet bubble tent lodging from $249 and curious ghost town to some of the finest smoked meats I've ever eaten, found at DB's Drumstick Iron Barbecue, and splurge-worthy post-hike massages at Desert Lotus Healing Arts, tiny Terra Lingua offers loads to do when you're not exploring the park. And my runner-up, Gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve, Alaska. With so many widely different U.S. national parks, it's nearly impossible to choose just one favorite. Though Gates of the Arctic is exceedingly tough to get to for most travelers, the remoteness allows for incredible magic. Here's why I loved it. Gates of the Arctic National Park is massive. Boasting nearly 8.5 million acres, Gates of the Arctic is the second largest national park in the country. That's really hard to fathom. It's larger than 10 Yosemites or 8 glaciers. Mountains and rivers seem to spill out forever here. I felt like I had a gigantic playground all to myself. A trip to Gates of the Arctic is a true adventure. No roads or trails cut through the Gates of the Arctic, so plan on hiking, boating, or flying in by bush plane. This remoteness means that solitude is easy to find and wildlife live in a setting largely removed from human contact, giving travelers a true wilderness experience. I sincerely relish those aspects after having to deal with the bus schedule of Denali. I signed up for a guided group expedition with Alaska Alpine Adventures, which is based in Anchorage and offers all kinds of epic hiking and rafting trips into the park, and this is from $6,195. Gates of the Arctic is an incredible place for wildlife watching. Loads of charismatic megafauna like grizzly bears, caribou, musk oxen, and Dall sheep call Gates of the Arctic home. Many of the area's 500,000-member Western Arctic caribou herd migrates to the park each fall. To say the Gates of the Arctic scenery is spectacular is an understatement. The Argetch Peaks are hands down one of the most beautiful landscapes I've ever laid eyes on. A bush plane dropped my guide and I off near the Argetch Valley on the banks of the Alatna River, and we set off on a 12-mile off-trail hike to these jagged pinnacles, which are part of the Central Brooks Range. We slept in tents and spent days exploring the granite slopes and aquamarine alpine lakes in the area. While this experience might not be for everyone, anyone willing to put in the miles will experience sublime natural beauty. And this was by a frequent outside contributor, Emily Pennington, who wrote a book about her experience of visiting all 63 national parks. Feral, Losing Myself and Finding My Way in America's National Parks. And this was published in 2023. Next year, she plans on returning to Gates of the Arctic to raft the Noatak River. And next up, we have Fox's new survival show, Extracted, has a sinister twist. The show pits 12 novice survivalists against each other in a test to win $250,000, but their families are also part of the game. This is by Frederick Dreyer. Things are not going well for Woody. The 50-year-old retired cop is thirsty and exhausted, and his attempts to spark a campfire using a ferro rod have failed miserably. Now Woody can't boil his drinking water. He stands in his barren campsite and raises a canteen filled with untreated pond water to his lips. "Lord, please don't let me get sick," he says into a camera. The shot cuts to the cozy confines of a television studio. Woody's son Blake and his nephew Colin watch him gulp down the nasty beverage on a massive television screen. Colin shakes his head and buries his face in his palms. End cut. This scene is the climax episode 1 of Extracted, a new outdoor survival show that debuted on Fox this past Monday. I recently watched the opening episode as well as advanced screeners for episodes 2 and 3 with my mouth agape. As a longtime fan of wilderness survival shows, you know, programs like Alone, Naked and Afraid, and Man vs. Wild, Extracted marks a stark turning point for the genre. Apparently, TV producers are now shipping everyday schmoes with zero wilderness training into the backwoods and filming them as they contract Giardia, and they're doing this for our entertainment. This element isn't even the weirdest part of Extraction, not by a long shot. The show's central premise is like an MK Ultra psychological experiment. 12 survivalists, yes I use this term lightly, are plucked from small town America and shipped off to a forested lake somewhere in British Columbia. They must stay there as long as possible, and the last one to remain wins $250,000. Producers have affixed dozens of surveillance cameras to the trees, rocks, and stumps in the air so we can spy on the 12 as they go about their business of building shelter, procuring food, going to the bathroom, and screaming into the void. But here's the real twist. Short distance away, producers have erected a TV studio, and each survivalist family members are stationed there, where they watch the action unfold 24 hours a day. At random points throughout the show, the family members are able to pack up survival gear, knives, cans of beans, bear spray, which are then delivered by flying drone to their loved one. The survivalists themselves cannot tap out. That job can only be done by the family members in the studio. A family member must march to the center of the studio and push a big and ridiculously red button that says Extract. I won't spoil the show, other than to say that the single cut rules creates a tension at the heart of Extracted. Contestants beg to be removed, but their loved ones don't always comply. While watching Extracted, I often thought about Blair Braverman's recent column about her collective affection for survival TV. Braverman, herself a former contestant on Naked and Afraid, makes more than a few pointed conclusions about why the TV genre is so beloved. Watching people in nature is relaxing. Survival connects us to our hunter-gatherer roots. We love cheering for and against characters. Watching the battle to survive is inherently relatable to everyday people. Negotiating jobs, health insurance, child and elder care, housing, that's all survival, viscerally so, Braverman wrote. Alas, I fear that the survival genre is quickly moving away from the themes Braverman adores. Extracted comes on the heels of Netflix releasing its first 2 seasons of its own survival game show, Outlast. Both shows tap into emotions that are more sinister and psychological reflexes inside us that are more ominous. In Outlast, the survivalists wage psychological war on each other throughout the season by switching teams, stealing gear, and destroying shelters, all for a chance at cash. The camera focuses on this drama, and it triggers some lobes inside our lizard brains. Extracted isn't quite as extreme, but the format of the show makes it feel dramatically different from Alone or Naked and Afraid. In Extracted, the audience views everyday people as they watch their loved ones suffer in nature. The tension created by these relationships drives our intrigue. We see caring mothers and fathers fail to deliver the survival goods that their cold and hungry son requires. We watch a divorced couple argue and question their parenting decisions as their teenage sons act like a toddler in the woods. Sure, there are moments of joy and triumph as well, but Extracted is still a voyeuristic look into a person watching a loved one in peril. As I watched it, I felt as though I was a scientist staring through reflective glass at a psychological experiment. It's no wonder that the frames linger on the black surveillance cameras dotting the forest. That said, Extracted has something that Outlast lacks, at least through its first 3 episodes. By choosing a novice, or downright inept, survivalist, the show is legitimately funny and more relatable than other survival shows. In episode 1, we meet the contestants and quickly learn that all of them will be fish out of water in the Canadian wilderness. One woman, Davina 41, is described as a hairdresser and a professional clown. "I think she's lost her mind," her sister Devin says into the camera. "She's been given everything her entire life by my parents and now her husband. He probably wipes her ass." A few scenes later, we see Davina sitting by the lake, bemoaning her experience outdoors. By this point, she's been in the woods for a little more than a day. "This is the hardest thing I've ever done in my life," she wails. I'll admit, Extracted made me laugh more than a few times, and that's why I plan to complete the series. I have no clue whether watching it will change my relationship with the outdoors or with my loved ones. And next up, we have Ask a Nudist. Your top naked hiking questions answered. We posed your top questions to our resident outdoor nudist fun hog. Every National Nude Day, we get a lot of questions. Is it fun? How likely is that my spouse will disown me? Yes, hard to say. This year, we pose your top questions to our resident outdoor nudist, Fun Hog. Here are her answers. Dear Nature Nudist, I don't love the way my body looks. Is nude hiking really for me? Best, nude improved. Dear Nude Improved, for many people who struggle with body image, naked hiking can sound like a nightmare. For years, I was one of those people. But then I was invited on a naked night hike with some close friends, and I found it liberating in ways I never expected. Instead of being embarrassed about my body, I was able to see it in a new way, as part of nature, as a vessel for all the joy and strength that I've been able to find through hiking. Hiking nude in a group can also be a beautiful source of perspective. We all have imperfections, and seeing and celebrating others up close could help you embrace your own. You've got this, Nature Nudist. Dear Nature Nudist, I have sensitive feet, but also don't want to cheat my attempt at nude adventures. Does it still count as naked hiking if I'm wearing shoes? Please advise. Twinkle Toes. Dear Twinkle Toes, yes, I absolutely recommend wearing shoes and socks, bug repellent, and sunblock for that matter. It also counts as naked if you're wearing a backpack or a hat or a bare naked belt. As with any outdoor endeavor, safety is paramount. But to be honest, I think you're asking the wrong question. What really matters is not that other people think it counts, but that you're pushing your own comfort zone and finding freedom and joy in the experience. Stay safe out there. Dear Nature Nudist, I'm planning to hashtag hike bare naked this year, but don't want to go alone. Are there nude hiking groups to join? How do I discreetly ask around without sounding strange? Sincerely, M. Bear asked. Dear M. Bear asked, first off, no one should be ashamed of doing things that bring them joy and for looking to share that joy with others. That said, there's a right time and place to ask other people to get naked with you. Your book club? Probably not. At a meetup group with other open-minded hikers? Much more likely. If you're nervous about asking around, try checking online first. You can find local nudist hiking groups on meetup.com or through the American Association for Nude Recreation. Happy hiking. Next up, we have why steeper is cheaper for climbing hills. New data suggests that the most efficient uphill slope is steeper than you think. Published February 14, 2025 by Alex Hutchinson. Consider this age-old dilemma. You're at the bottom of a hill and you want to go to the top. Should you head straight up the steepest slope or switch back and forth at a gentler incline? The answer depends on the context. If you're on a marked trail, for example, you should definitely stick to the prescribed switchbacks. But a more general answer involves digging into the physics. That's the goal of a new study in the journal Medicine and Science in Sports and Exercise from a research team led by David Looney and Adam Potter of the U.S. Army Research Institute of Environmental Medicine. Previous researchers have found that steeper is cheaper for runners, meaning that it takes less energy to ascend directly up steeper slopes. But it wasn't clear whether the same true for walkers and backpackers, or whether the answer changed depending on how hot or cold it is. For starters, it's worth looking back at trail running data. In 2016, researchers at the University of Colorado decided to study the increasingly popular world of vertical kilometer races. The total elevation gain in these races is set at 1,000 meters, or 3,281 feet, but every course is different. A steep slope will have a shorter course distance, but be harder to run up. A gentle slope will be easier to run up, but cover a longer total distance. For a given finishing time, what's the sweet spot? The Colorado researchers built the world's steepest treadmill, capable of reaching a slope of 45 degrees, 100% grade, in other words. To put that in perspective, a black diamond ski run is typically about 25 degrees, and gym treadmills rarely go more than 9 degrees. They had to line the treadmill belt with sandpaper for grip, and then even then runners couldn't stay balanced beyond 40 degrees. They tested runners at a variety of slopes, with the treadmill speed adjusted so that they were always gaining elevation at the same rate, equivalent to a vertical kilometer and very respectable time of 48 minutes. The world record is just under 30 minutes. Here's what the results look like for walking. Black circles and running, white circles with metabolic rate, basically how quickly they are burning calories on the vertical axis. So this shows a graph of metabolic power on the y-axis, so the vertical one, and then angle or degrees of the incline on the x-axis or horizontal axis. And so walking, it's metabolic power at the angle, low degrees, it takes more power and less power as you go down to about 30 degrees and it starts increasing. And for running, again, it's more power at the lower degrees, 10 degrees, and decreasing as you get to 25 degrees and 30 degrees and increasing at 35 and 40 degrees. So at gentle slopes like 10 degrees, it takes a lot of energy to climb because the treadmill is moving rapidly fast to gain the required elevation. At steeper slopes, the calorie burn decreases. Steeper is indeed cheaper, at least up to a point. Beyond about 30 degrees, calorie burn starts increasing again, presumably because the incline is now so steep that it's hard to climb efficiently. The sweet spot then is between 20 and 30 degrees, which as it turns out corresponds to the average slope of the courses where the fast vertical kilometers are held. You might also notice that walking burns less energy than running for most of the steeper slopes. That's the truth that most mountain and trail runners eventually discover for themselves. However, it doesn't necessarily mean that you should only walk up hills, as I explored in this article in the Walk Run Dilemma and Trail Running. And there's a link. The best slopes for hikers? Climbing a kilometer in 48 minutes is really fast. The aerobic equivalent of running as hard as you can for 10K. So it's not clear that the Colorado results have much relevance for backpackers or military personnel. Looney and his colleagues decided to run similar experiments at a range of much slower climbing speeds. The Colorado study had a climbing rate of 21 vertical meters per minute. Looney's study looked at four different climbing rates of between 1.9 and 7.8 meters per minute, much more realistic range for hikers. The overall results are similar to the running results. Steeper was once again cheaper. For each climbing rate, choosing a steeper slope corresponded to a burning fewer calories. As with running data, there's probably a point where getting too steep becomes counterproductive. But the steepest slope in Looney's study was only about 13 degrees, and in that range, steeper was always better. There was an additional wrinkle in Looney's protocol. The military is increasingly focused on Arctic operations, so they ran the same protocol at three different temperatures, 32, 50, and 68 degrees Fahrenheit. The two warmer temperatures were basically the same, but the data at 32 degrees was slightly different. At slower vertical climbing rate, calorie burn rates were higher than normal at 32 degrees, because the subjects were spending extra energy keeping themselves warm by shivering and activating their brown fat. At high vertical climbing rates, calorie burn rates were roughly the same, regardless of temperature, presumably because they were working hard enough to stay warm even at 32 degrees. In cold temperatures, in other words, pushing harder can sometimes be more efficient because it saves you the energetic cost of keeping yourself warm. Conversely, you might imagine that the steepest slopes would cause problems in really hot conditions because you're more likely to overheat. And the takeaway? The most important caveat to keep in mind when interpreting these results is that the comparisons are based on fixed climbing rate. If you're at the bottom of a hill and want to get to the top in a given amount of time, then choosing a steeper route will generally save you energy. If you've got all the time in the world and don't care how long it takes you to reach the summit, then you might well choose to take a gentler route that will feel easier as you climb. Most of us, though, live in a world where time is scarce. Even when we're not racing vertical kilometers, we're hoping to make it to the summit and back or to the next campsite before dark. In that situation, if you're choosing between two routes, remember this. If one route is twice as steep as the other, you'd have to walk twice as fast up the gentler slope to reach the top at the same time. Counterintuitive though it may sound, that data shows that under most circumstances, twice as steep is easier than twice as fast. You have been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I've been reading from Outside Magazine. My name is Dave Rogowski. Thank you for listening.